chapter 7, seated at the table. And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Luke 15:2. As I weaved my way back to the place where we had been, I couldn't find the man anywhere. His ladder and pruning shears were gone. There were traces in the dirt and leaves where I had sat against the tree, but the tree stump was gone as well. Had he forgotten we were to meet? Did I misunderstand something or do something wrong? "I'll be here when you get back," he had said. I began searching the immediate area, but found no indication of where he had gone. All sorts of feelings and thoughts began to surface. Was this a trick? Did he even care about his promise? Disappointment began to turn into anger, the more I thought about it. But that wasn't him at all. He had been nothing but kind, gentle, loving, honest, truthful. He was also focused, determined, and meticulous. As I thought more about the kind of person he was and how he had responded to me already, I began to realize I needed to be proactive. He had worked diligently without saying anything, leaving it to me to ask questions and press in. Maybe that's what was happening now. Instead of worrying or being offended and doubting what he had said, I decided to do something about it. I decided to speak up. "Sir," I called out. "Sir," again louder. "I'm back from the river. I've washed and changed and planted the seeds like you said." Nothing. I decided to move on and search for him. Where else could I go? I thought to myself. He's the only one who has helped me so far. I had already been to the river and back, and he wasn't that way. I decided not to backtrack to the bridge either, but to simply press forward on the clearest path through the garden. As I went, I kept calling out, "Sir, where are you? Sir, I'm back from the river." No more than a few minutes down the path, I heard a familiar response.
"You're on the right path. Just keep coming."
My heart jumped, and I quickened my pace. The next major curve in the path opened up to a wide clearing lined with all sorts of trees and filled with a variety of flowering shrubs, flowers, and ornamental grasses. The smell alone was intoxicating, and I stood in wonder, mesmerized by the rays of golden light coming into the clearing through the trees. At the far end, across the lawn, was a large, rectangular farmhouse table. The gardener was laughing and pulling out one of the chairs, waving for me to come join him. The beauty of this place was overwhelming. "I've washed and changed and planted the seeds as you instructed," I reported as I approached. "Yes, you have changed, in more ways than one," he laughed again as he pulled me in for a crushing hug. It felt both awkward and completely normal at the same time. My family didn't hug, but this man was so safe and kind, yet so unpredictable and full of life that I couldn't not embrace him. "And you found me," he exclaimed. "And this place, it's worth seeking, isn't it?" "It's beautiful," I said, trying all at once to look in every direction. "But I know you're hungry and thirsty," he continued. "Come, rest and eat. We have things to talk about." With that, he directed me to an open chair. On the table were plates and wooden bowls full of breads, fruits, cheeses, and cuts of meat, along with cups of different sizes and pitchers filled with milk, water, and what looked to be a variety of juices. To me, it was a veritable feast. As soon as I was seated, I looked across the table at the man and suddenly realized my dream from that morning was happening right in front of me. Here was a man seated at a table, a large wooden table made of long, rough-cut boards. Another chair had been pulled out across from him as if for a guest. Small, round bread loaves in a wooden bowl had been set out next to wooden cups. With his thick flannel shirt and leather boots, he looked like he lived in the woods on this side of the river. Large, calloused hands resting on the tabletop. Kind, brown eyes with a gentle smile framed by a thick, untrimmed beard. We locked eyes, and then it ended. Only now, it wasn't ending, but just beginning. He looked at me with a deep, knowing expression. "You needed to understand that this was no chance meeting," he said. "It is the beginning of a whole new life for you, and one you must take seriously." He knew about the dream, I thought. He knew I needed a bath and clothes before I did. He knew I would seek for him and find him here. Who is this man? There's only one person I'd ever read about that acted and talked like this and did these kinds of things. But how could that be possible? With a newfound wonder in my heart, we dove into conversation and the delicious meal. It was the only food I'd eaten in 3 days, and the man paced his conversation to my appetite, talking while I ate, and then asking more questions once I was satisfied. At first, he talked about gardening and the seasons, about fruits and insects and squirrels and birds. He had an incredibly deep understanding of how it all worked together and how to create these beautiful gardens. I asked a few questions as I ate, but mostly I enjoyed listening to him talk about the things he loved. Having eaten more than my fill, I finally pushed back from my plate and the conversation began to slow down. The man asked about my family back home. I tried staying on the surface, talking about school and friends, about our summer camping trip, and about our neighbor, John. He let me hold up the momentum of the conversation until I ran out of things to say, and then it got quiet. "What was your relationship with your dad like growing up?" he asked. "It was okay," I said half-heartedly as I picked at my plate. "My dad was a good man, a good provider, a hard worker. I respect him for that." "That's good," he said. "It's important to honor your dad. I'm sure he is a hard worker. He taught you to be diligent and follow through on instructions, so that's something. But I want to know about your relationship with your dad. What was it like growing up with him?" "I don't know. I guess there were some things that were hard, but everyone goes through that. I mean, that's normal, right?" The man just shook his head as if to say, "Keep going." There was some yelling between us. A few times he got physical, but I wouldn't say it was abusive like what some people go through. Compared to other people I know, I had it good. He paused long enough to wait until I looked up at him. "The thorn tips in your hands were so small you could barely see them," he said. "Did that keep you from getting infected and sick?" "No," I agreed. He had a good point. The size of the wound isn't what matters, but whether or not it's treated, he said. Untreated wounds, big and small, become infected with bitterness. And in the realm of the heart, bitterness is what destroys people. "But a lot of that was years ago. My dad has changed a lot, so it feels weird to bring all that up," I protested. "Do you think that if enough time had passed, your hands would have healed on their own? Is it time that heals wounds?" he asked. I shook my head from side to side. If I hadn't gotten help in time, I wouldn't have survived. "But now that I'm here with you, why does it matter?" It came out more as a statement than a question. "It does matter," he said. "It matters because it happened to you. And everything that happens to you matters because you matter. You're valuable. Your whole life is valuable. Don't cheapen those things because they were years ago or because it feels unimportant." "I figured I would just rub some dirt in it and move on," I said with a half smile. I guess I expected that to be kind of funny, but he didn't laugh. "Is that what healed the wounds in your hands?" he asked softly. "No," I answered. "But my hands were in pain. With all this stuff with my dad, it doesn't really hurt. I mean, I don't feel anything. Sometimes I feel frustrated or angry, but I don't feel like it's painful." "Remember the trees I was pruning when you first walked up?" he asked. "Yes, I remember," I said. "You couldn't see the roots, but that doesn't mean they aren't there or that they don't matter," he said. "Those roots nourish the tree. What's hidden, in many ways, is more important than what you can see. I nodded as he spoke, so he kept going. Why did you leave home? He asked. I wasn't expecting that, but I knew he would see right through my shallow excuses. My dad wasn't easy to live with, I said. That's true, but I didn't ask about your dad, he said. I asked why you left home. Maybe it would be better to ask how you left home. That was an easy one. Angry, I said. It wasn't good, that's for sure. Do you think anger is wrong? He asked. It definitely feels wrong, I said. It's not, he said surprisingly. What does the Bible say about anger? He asked. I don't know, I fumbled, embarrassed to admit that I hadn't read a Bible in years, at least outside of church. Paul writes about it in his letter to the church in Ephesus, he said. In your anger, don't sin. Don't let the sun go down while you are still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Anger is a healthy response to something that's wrong, but when sin follows, then you know it's not just anger anymore. Does this make sense? It does, I said, but to me it all feels the same. How many times did you go to bed as a young boy with anger or fear or disappointment or hurt in your heart toward your dad? He asked. Too many to count, I replied. Then you know the devil had a foothold in your heart, he said, and his goal is always to sow seeds of lies and deception into those places, like dirt in a wound that breeds infection. The more you rehearsed the pain while agreeing with his lies, the more your thoughts became bitter and infected. In those years, your hurt and anger was transformed into bitterness and rage until your memories with your dad became toxic. But everyone eventually needs to break with their parents and start their own life, I argued. Isn't it a healthy thing to want to leave home and go my own way? I was grasping now, trying to avoid the pain gnawing at my chest. No one leaves home the wrong way unless something is wrong, unless there's pain. Home is where your first relationships are created. It's where you learn how to be in relationship. If there is brokenness and pain back there in the roots, you can be sure it won't just fix itself. That root pain is going to show up in one way or another in the fruit of all your relationships until it's healed. I could feel the tug of war inside between the truth he was speaking and my desire to keep everything under control. It was a war between pride and weakness, between my desire for independence and admitting I was hurt and running. Suddenly, a scene flashed before me as if I was watching it happen to someone else on a TV. It was the moment on the bridge when I couldn't take another step. The words of my desperate prayer replayed in my own ears. Oh God, I am not strong. My strength has left me, and I am sorry for ever thinking I could be strong on my own. I am not independent. I need you right now just to live. Be my strength, O God, and do for me what I cannot do for myself. The last part of John's note had been the key all along. Only remember as you go that the tears of a godly sorrow will deliver you in a way that no amount of strength can. Don't fight your tears. Choose weakness, and you will find strength. My heart felt like a dam with millions of gallons of water on the other side, and I wasn't sure I wanted this dam to break, or even if it would. I sat quietly for a minute, not knowing what to do or think or say. As if in response to my thoughts, the man spoke again. How did you see your dad when you were growing up? He asked. His question was like a key being thrust into my heart, and as the question turned in me, something inside, like a vault, began to open up. Suddenly, a flood of memory started to replay in my mind like a movie, many of which had been locked away or forgotten about for years. And then I began to feel that little boy's emotions all over again, There I was, yelling at my dad on the back porch just a few days ago. I could feel the blood rushing to my face. There I am at 16, coming home nervous from my first wreck. I know it's my fault. I'm scared to say anything to my dad, but I know I can't hide it. I can still see his face, his anger and disappointment. "I can't believe it," he says as he shakes his head and walks away. "You can pay for that one yourself." Another memory at 12 years old, asking to help Dad with the lawnmower. His hands are black with grease as he struggles to loosen a bolt, obviously frustrated. I stand there wanting to help, but he won't look up. I feel in the way and incapable, and finally he tells me to find something else to do. I just want to be with my dad. Then at 9 years old, Mom is crying at the kitchen table as Dad storms out of the house yelling and slams the back door. I feel so unsafe and confused. Did I do something wrong? Are they going to split up? Is he coming back? All of the familiar emotions begin to wash over me, but instead of anger, it just hurt. I could feel hot tears rolling down my cheeks as a flood of memories and snapshots from my childhood kept playing. Mostly, it just felt like my dad was either angry or disinterested. In most of my memories, he was silent, distracted, or the look on his face was mean or disappointed. Finally, I just let go and put my head down on the table and wept. At first, I didn't know all that was in there, but then when I realized it, I was afraid that if I allowed myself to feel it, I would be completely overwhelmed. But somehow, being with this man and hearing his words made everything different. I felt hope. Instead of being angry, sad, and hopeless, I felt all the pain, but I felt lighter, like something had been lifted off of me. For a while, we both just sat there, saying nothing. It helped to have some space to breathe. Finally, as I wiped away the tears, I felt a gentle hand on my shoulder. His voice was soft and steady as he looked at me. "You've been given a great gift," he said. "You've been allowed to see the roots of pain in your own heart so that you could grieve a godly sorrow. Without this, you could never see the lies for what they are and accept the truth from your heavenly Father." I can't explain the joy and peace that flooded my heart when he spoke those words, "Heavenly Father." I knew there was a God. I believed in God, but it had never entered my mind that I had a heavenly Father. Something deep inside began to long for this, whatever or whoever he was. "When you stood by the mower waiting for your dad to include you, did you think there was something wrong with him for being frustrated? Or did you think there was something wrong with you?" he asked. That hit a nerve. I felt like I wasn't big enough or responsible enough to help him, like I was in the way. I guess I felt it was something wrong with me. "Looking back now, do you think that's true?" he asked. "Was there something wrong with you?" I had never even questioned that feeling. It was never a conscious thought. But I suddenly realized there was a mountain of emotions and insecurities tied to that very moment and so many others just like it. In fact, now that I saw it as an adult, I don't even think my dad noticed what was happening. He was just frustrated with a broken lawnmower, probably in a hurry, and I happened to be standing there with no ability to help him. He hadn't intended to reject me, but I felt rejected and stupid. I had believed a lie, not a lie my dad told me, but a lie that came from somewhere else. "I want you to put these on," he said as he handed me a pair of sunglasses. It seemed an odd thing to do at the moment, but I complied, and as I slipped them onto my face, everything went completely yellow. All of the greens and browns of the trees and the blues and whites of the sky were washed with a single color. "What do you see?" he asked. "Everything is yellow," I said. That's right, he said. Everything takes on the color of the lenses, not its real color. As I pulled the sunglasses off, everything went back to normal. I'm not sure I see what you're getting at, I said. Unhealed pain in the heart, like the thorns in your hands, breeds the infection of bitterness. And bitterness is a lens that has colored everything you see. Once bitterness with your dad took root, it began to color every relationship, every interaction, every conversation. The way your dad treated you at times caused you pain. It even caused you to feel rejected. But you chose to go to bed every night and rehearse that pain and agree with lies until it turned into bitterness. What he did hurt you, like a thorn in your skin. But lies mixed with your own bitterness is the infection that is destroying your life on the inside. I knew he spoke truth. I could feel it working deep inside of my heart, clearing up years of confusion and chaos in my mind. But something else inside of me didn't want to let go. The pain was familiar, even comfortable. Though I didn't have words back then to define it like that, to let go of the anger felt unfair, even a little unsafe. As if reading my mind, the man answered my thoughts. The anger you've carried for years is simply a wall of self-protection for your own heart, to protect you from the pain you feel with your dad. It's the visible fruit that has grown out of a hidden root of bitterness. This is what the Bible means when it says, "See to it that no one falls short of the grace of God, and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many." But what else was I supposed to do? I asked desperately. How was I supposed to know at 9 and 12 years old how to handle all of this? How is this my fault? Come with me, he said. There's something you need to know. Standing up from the table, the man cleared away the cups and bowls. And then, to my complete shock, he began to break apart the table. The long, heavy boards and wooden pegs holding it together began to crack and split apart. I stood back in amazement as he used his bare hands to pry apart every joint and seam with a strength and speed that defied reason. After just a few minutes, we stood in front of a pile of rough lumber. He was barely even sweating. I was just wondering what in the world he was thinking when I heard, "Help me carry these." He had to be joking. I wasn't sure if I could lift more than a single board, but he quickly hoisted two onto my shoulders and steadied me. Still wobbly from my ordeal over the past days, it took a few steps to adjust, but soon I was following his lead. The rest of the table was on his broad shoulders. It was like watching an ox under a load. His strength wasn't human. We wound our way through a broad path in the trees until we reached the edge of a clearing near the river, stopping once so I could get a breath and reposition the large wooden planks on my shoulders. The man had stopped speaking, and I noticed that he grew more solemn, even slowing his pace a little. Everything seemed more deliberate, more focused. Something like sadness, or maybe just seriousness, had settled over him. He walked beyond me a little ways to the edge of the water, dropped his load, and sat down in the loose gravel and loamy soil. As he did, the wind picked up. Leaves began to swirl around, and I could hear the trees behind us beginning to rustle and moan. Seconds later, as if timed to our arrival, thick clouds rolled in, blocking the warmth and light of the sun. Pulling my hands into my sleeves, I sat arms crossed on top of my boards, deciding to wait on the man rather than ask for an explanation. I had no sooner tucked my chin into my chest for warmth when I was jolted to my feet by a blinding explosion of light, followed by a deafening clap of thunder. As the sound continued to echo out, my eyes readjusted, and there, barely visible through the thick darkness, stood a crude wooden cross. It had been fashioned somehow from the pile of lumber, but the man was nowhere in sight. Was I dreaming? It seemed real, yet not possible. Walking closer, I rubbed my eyes, hoping to wake up, and when I looked again, there was a man stretched out over the rough wooden frame, just like a picture I had seen at church. I stood horrified to see something like a rusty railroad spike about to be driven into his right hand. What in the world was happening? Who would do something like this? Why was I being shown this gruesome sight? Try as I did to look away, I couldn't take my eyes off the man. As the spike was driven into his hand, his face jerked upward in pain, and through the darkness I could see that it was none other than the gardener, the one who had healed my hands, the friend who had rescued me and nursed me back to health. How could this be? His eyes were shut, and his face was racked with pain. I looked back to the spike in his hand and saw clearly the word written on it, bitterness. When I read that word, it was as though the spike was driven into my own heart. It was my bitterness being driven into his right hand. I could hardly stand. The pain was so great. I didn't want to look up again, but as I did, I saw another spike about to be driven into his left hand, and on it was written another word, rejection. As this second spike pierced my rescuer's left hand and the groans of pain left his lips, I was undone. I could see and feel the pain of rejection, my pain of being ignored and rejected by my dad. My dad's pain from my own rebellion and disrespect, all of it in one moment being driven into the hand of the gardener. Why was my problem being put into him? He had done nothing but help and heal the wounds of my own hands. I fell to the ground with my arms over my head. The injustice of it all was too great to bear. Suddenly a thought came to me. What if he becomes angry? No one is able to take this kind of unfair treatment. What if he realizes it's my fault and takes it out on me? Then I will be the one up on those wooden beams. He is much stronger than I am, and there's no way I will escape his wrath and vengeance once he realizes I'm the one to blame. Pinned to the ground with guilt and shame, I was compelled to look up one last time, risking the penalty of his wrath. All I could manage to see from where I lay were his feet dangling there. And then, to my horror, a third spike was being prepared. On it was written three words, guilt and shame. At the sight of those words, I squeezed my eyes shut and buried my face in the dirt. The sound of the hammer on that spike beat against my own body with a great force, and I thought that I would never stand again. I listened for the sounds of his cries, but none came. Only a quiet muttering, and as I strained to hear it, he said, "Brother, get up and look at me." Oh, how could I stand and do that? But I did get up, and slowly my eyes met his. But instead of wrath and vengeance, I found myself staring into the most beautiful, the most loving eyes I had ever seen. Deep, brown pools of kindness and forgiveness. Though racked with pain and sorrow, he still looked at me, never turning away. "Brother," he said again, "I love you with an everlasting love. I have no judgment against you. Here in the land of freedom, I set you free." My heart was broken. Everything I thought I knew lay shattered all around me. As tears rolled down my face and heaving sobs escaped my chest, I could not look away. His eyes rolled back, his face turned upward. A long breath went into his lungs, and I heard a deafening cry escape. "Father, forgive him. He didn't know what he was doing. With that, the bulky frame of the gardener and my friend sunk down on the nails. His head dropped and fell limp, and I realized he was suddenly gone. And I had never asked his name. My heart was filled with love for him, and I knew he had somehow taken my place and suffered a penalty I deserved. In that instant, I felt the sizzle of electricity as every hair on my neck and arm stood up in a split second of static. Then a flash of light engulfed my body and I crumpled to the ground. The thunderclap I anticipated felt oddly distant as it echoed through my mind and then faded. The only sensation was the warmth of sunlight on my skin. But I realized my eyes were still closed, though I felt as if I still was standing next to the river under dark clouds.